Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, October 1st, 2020, is exactly 1 month and 3 days before the November 3rd national election in the USA. Exactly a century ago, during the presidential election of 1920, the famous muckraker H.L. Mencken wrote in the Baltimore Sun, "A democracy is perfected. The office of the president represents more and more closely the inner souls of the people. On some great and glorious day, the plain folks of the land will reach their heart's desire at last, and the White House will be occupied by a downright fool and complete narcissistic moron." Quote, unquote. That prophetic statement concerned the impending election of Warren G. Harding that year, following the ending in 1918 of World War I and the great influenza pandemic of 1918 to 1920, which killed some 50 million or more worldwide, and at least 600,000 Americans, which included the immigrant grandfather of current President Donald Trump. Harding, who died in office his first term in 1923, ran on a platform of a return to normalcy. Donald Trump, as president a century later, plus a new millennium, has in contrast destroyed virtually every norm, especially those regarding conflict of interest and speaking truth, and no such luck that he will die before his first term expires this next January 20th, which, if there is justice in the world, will be his only term. Trump, however, is scathingly demanding a second term in the White House, whether he does not actually win the vote. He lost the popular vote by nearly 3 million 4 years ago. And he threatens to not submit to losing this election with the claim his loss would be the result of a corrupt election. There has been no bottom to Trump's gross awfulness these past 4 years as president, and now he both horrifies and angrily disgusts the tolerant propriety of most Americans, who do not consider a presidency to be a dictatorship. Nor do most Americans equate the probability of his losing re-election as proof positive that it has been, in his words, rigged. The repulsive President Trump, who does regard his immortal self as Big Daddy Donald Magnifico, pompously manipulates the dark forces of racist insurrection with no other concern than his own personal imperial supremacy. His proto-Nazi stormtroopers, such repellent mental misfits as Proud Boys, QAnon, Boogaloos, with the same insensitive disregard and ineptness that has cost the lives of more than 200,000 Americans in less than a year of plague, with barely a blip of concern. Only how the toll, which he subtracts considerably, affects his chances for re-election. The only real antidote for the coronavirus in the USA will be Trump's removal from causing further harm. The integrity of voting has never been so crucial to America's short history of democratic governance, which Trump has consistently maligned in his truly obscene claim of absolute majesty, as well as his despicable resistance to the peaceful exchange of power, which has distinguished our troubled history. Trump has even broadly hinted at nepotism with boorish remarks of succession by his vapid daughter and her useless husband. This seems reminiscent of early Japanese emperors who retired to pull the strings of their imperial heirs, in toto with a powerful shogunate, in this circumstance, the proto-Richelieu attorney general. What Trump seems unable to process or benignly ignores is that he is unleashing also a possible retaliation and likelihood of his own assassination, which occurred to the first Republican president who was on a counter trajectory of unity rather than division. our tattered democracy must yet persevere because of Trump's narcissistically unstable penchant for turmoil in consort with his unfettered dishonesty and corruption. If Trump refuses to leave office following electoral defeat, that would certainly be an impeachable offense. Just so. The intrinsic job of Americans as free-born heirs of revolutionaries who established constitutional democracy, flawed as it has proven to be, is to depose a despot who has threatened to abolish birthright citizenship, among multitudes of other despicably totalitarian edicts he has espoused. Trump's war against the vote demands that he be voted out of the presidency. Trump and his counterfeit cabal are instead attempting to make irrelevant the citizens' right to vote. They trivialize it, call it bogus and corrupt, in hopes Americans will lose faith in their own most basic democratic obligation and prerogative of governance, the true power of the people. Which is the subject I read next, something I have written and preached before on this program? For life and liberty. Once again, the United States of America is in need of a revolution to thwart incipient tyranny and the blatant attempt by a consortium of robber barons and corrupt politicos, whom the framers of the Constitution warned us against, from seizing control of the feeble remnants of government that operate on the behalf of the people. This necessary revolution is underwritten in the nation's principles and is as sweeping in its implications as the original revolt against English rule, which was as corrupt, despotic, and hubristic as the American government has deformed into the past few decades. This revolution is within the law. It is supported by the law, in design, if seldom in practice. And the law not only provides its mechanics, the law, in a very real sense, depends on it to maintain its integrity. This revolution is more binding than the ancient right to remove emperors in old China, or revolt against kings and church in medieval Europe. This revolution is the vote. Guaranteed after intense struggle and diverse constitutional amendments to all citizens, which too many more abuse by disuse than misuse. On average, less than 50% of eligible voters in this country vote. Disgust and perceived powerlessness, not apathy, alienate millions of citizens from the polls and are major sources of great public discontent that affects even those who do vote but are discouraged and fed up. That discontent might be tapped by concentrating on registering to vote the many millions who have either dropped out of the political process or have never been given much opportunity or incentive to participate in it. If these millions of ordinary people were to rise from their bitter cynicism and phlegmatic despair and use nothing more than their constitutional right to vote, they will discover they have the power to transform much of what has gone off track in our recent history. It is time to recognize that the heart of our liberty is disappearing in the despair of the deprived and disenfranchised. Non-voters are generally economically impaired and suffer most from inequities and corruption, with little chance of prosperity in the existing status quo. Yet the potential of real power lies within these disaffected masses. There are more genuine, emphasis on genuine, grassroots organizations than at any time in the nation's history, all waiting for a real chance to voice their concerns, issues, and visions. All politics are local. While the trend seems to favor high-pressure political professionals funded by large amounts of money, which increasingly fragments the electorate with nasty advertising and big bucks-backed candidates, whose sponsors are now granted anonymity, they remain vulnerable to grassroots campaigning organized at the neighborhood level in every community in the USA. We have allowed the vote to be trivialized and made much less than its true potency. Money has been granted equal to free speech in elections without disclosure of its source. The cash that candidates accept supersedes the vote, which is treated as a commodity to be purchased and virtually ensures their continuance in office. Securely established incumbents count on fewer people to vote to maintain power and on ever larger contributions from wealthy and corporate sponsors who use their money to turn campaigns into public ordeals of fear and loathing. Paradoxically, as almost direct cause and effect, fewer Americans voting cheapens the vote as well as makes it cheaper to purchase. Not voting is a virtual assurance those who do not vote will remain powerless as they become increasingly victimized. The next most necessary thing we must do is to ensure that our votes count, which means demanding verification of our votes. The best way to do that is replace suspiciously tamper-prone, high-tech voting machines with paper ballots, which is the method most world democracies continue to use because it is the most reliable. Paper ballots are counted by people, not by machines. There are no patent liabilities or proprietary claims involved in the process of hand-counting votes, and the checks and balances and rechecks to ensure the accuracy and honesty of counting ballots are required by law. And ultimately, as with juries, the people who count ballots regard their task with grave responsibility, a weighty, passionate, and essential sense of the obligation of citizenship that machinery does not feel. People can, of course, be manipulated and corrupted, but never so easily as machines, especially technology designed and marketed by the very political corporate military fraternity that has most to gain from rigging elections. Oregon currently uses optical scan election systems to count the state's mail-in ballots. The Oregon Voter Rights Coalition, which was formed after the 2004 election, in which 98% of Oregon's votes were tabulated on voting machines manufactured by the very corporations implicated in nationwide computer voting fraud, says that it is necessary for every voter to be informed about the facts of voting machine use and the possibility of corruption. Suggestions to reduce the possibility of fraud include the demand that corporations and politicians get out of counting the votes, and that's a quote. Also, that open source election software be used for transparency, as well as the use of scientifically designed election verification processes. Methods of ensuring election integrity incorporate logic and accuracy tests, audits of precincts, countywide and or statewide verification, and recounts of votes by hand counting all paper ballots for races that are in doubt. Most importantly, the Oregon Voter Rights Coalition exhorts voters to not let elections go unchallenged. We do not have a political system that presents us with the best choices our country is capable of offering. If it did, we would never have got such an absurd depravity as Donald Trump in the White House. The insular filtration process of just two political parties screens out nearly everybody qualified for public office and is so ripe for constitutional infidelity that it extensively awards a gluttonous minority over the interests of everybody else. Oregon was the first state to authorize all vote by mail in 2000, which was, of course, a millennial milestone. Since then, Oregon has consistently had one of the highest turnouts of voters in the USA. Voter fraud in Oregon is deterred by requiring each voter to sign their ballot mailing envelope, and votes are counted at each county clerk's office rather than at polling sites. The nation's political, economic, and most certainly its ethical structure needs massive and genuine change to transfer power and equitable wealth back to the constitutional majority of ordinary citizens who are the major stockholders of democracy. This 2020 election, 1 month and 3 days from today's date, on November 3rd, is among the most important in the nation's history between foul and unjust despotism or admittedly flawed, but redemptible constitutional democracy. And that was something I wrote for Life and Liberty. And as I mentioned earlier, I've read on this program before. And now, by Eric Klinenberg, How Libraries Can Save the 2020 Election. He is a sociologist at New York University and wrote this for the New York Times. As states rush to adapt their election systems amid the coronavirus pandemic, officials estimate that 80 million Americans plan to vote by mail this fall, twice as many as in 2016. Because of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy's decision to remove or cripple key components of America's mail system just weeks before Election Day and President Trump's open efforts to discredit mail-in voting, millions are worried their ballots won't be counted in time or even counted at all. Congressional Democrats and several governors from both parties have called for Mr. DeJoy to reinstall the high-speed sorting machines and mailboxes that he removed in an inexplicable hurry. He flatly refused. The House passed a $25 billion bill to revive the Postal Service before the election. The Republican-controlled Senate refused to consider it. New York's Attorney General Letitia James called the Postal Service system overhaul nothing more than a voter suppression tactic. But a speedy judicial resolution is unlikely. Fortunately, there is a largely overlooked part of the civic infrastructure that is ready and able to help Americans exercise the franchise, even under these troubling circumstances: libraries. Libraries already serve as polling places on Election Day throughout the country, and crucially, they provide secure, monitored ballot boxes where absentee voters can drop off their ballots before November 3rd and know that it will count. Secure boxes for absentee ballots are already available at some libraries in states like California, Colorado, Florida, Illinois, Utah, and Washington. Other states should follow suit. There are more than 9,000 public libraries across the United States, in cities, suburbs, rural areas, and small towns. In surveys, libraries rank among the most trusted institutions in America. They assist with the census and offer voter registration services. They are open to everyone. They are nonpartisan. They are free. Even in today's fractured digital age, libraries rank among the most popular and well-visited places in our cultural landscape. According to a 2019 Gallup poll, on average, U.S. adults go to the library nearly once a month, making library visits the most common cultural activity Americans engage in by far. And that's a quote. So why not lean on their relative stability and popularity amid this crisis? For those curious about how the process of early voting at a library works, the mechanics are remarkably simple. As explained by the U.S. Electoral Assistance Commission, an independent bipartisan body that certifies the nation's voting systems, voters may deliver their ballots to a drop box, a secure, locked structure operated by election officials, from the time they receive them in the mail up to the time polls close on Election Day. The commission presciently notes that early use of ballot boxes are especially beneficial when voters experience lack of trust in the postal process, fear that their ballot could be tampered with, or concern that their signature will be exposed. And if they are worried about meeting the postmark deadline and ensuring that their ballot is returned in time to be counted. In the past few weeks, local leaders in a number of states have moved to expand the supply of ballot boxes at libraries. In Milwaukee, concerns about delays in the postal system and the coronavirus pandemic led officials to install 15 new steel ballot drop-off boxes at branches around the city. Officials in King County, Washington, just installed a similar network of secure ballot boxes at libraries. County workers carefully selected branch locations so that more than 90% of residents live within 3 miles of a drop box. The goal, the election board wrote in a fact sheet, is, quote, to remove barriers to voting and to support every eligible King County resident to exercise their right to participate in decisions about their community, unquote. Perhaps in a less polarized time, expanding early voting at libraries would be uncontroversial, Unfortunately, officials in some states and counties have shown little interest in easing hurdles to voting. In Ohio, an important swing state where residents in Democratic-leaning counties are deeply concerned about long lines and dangerous conditions for in-person voters, library leaders in Cuyahoga County called for the state to install a network of drop-off boxes similar to those in Washington and Wisconsin. Frank LaRose, Ohio Secretary of State, a Republican whose office oversees election processes, denied the request. Mr. LaRose will allow only one ballot box per county and only at a Board of Elections office. The Ohio Democratic Party filed a lawsuit to force the state to install more boxes. It's unclear, however, whether the courts will make a ruling in time to force any potential changes. Under the status quo, the United States is barreling toward a historic democratic crisis. The legitimacy of our entire electoral system, and with it our federal government, is at stake. Making ballot boxes widely available at libraries and at accessible outdoor places is a safe and inexpensive way for government at all levels to promote our core civic duty. It should be a universal goal among state leaders. It is already clear that neither the President nor Congress nor the Postal Service will do what is necessary to ensure the integrity of the 2020 election. The library, still among the most revered institutions in our fragile democratic experiment, may well be our best hope. And that was How Libraries Can Save the 2020 Election by Eric Klindenberg, who is a professor in the social sciences at New York University and the author of Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. And he wrote this for the New York Times. And now, again, something I wrote. And I have read it at least once or twice on this program and published it in my old, now defunct newspaper. I call it Keep Your Head. And a quote by Peter Vanastart: the terrible truth emerged that religion, art, scholarship, and politics only disguised conflicts far worse than those of animals. The only possible survival for a democracy is to erect and maintain a balance between its conflicting factions and allow none of them to gain such power as to be capable of suppressing or ravaging the rest. Democracy is an elaborate, though inherently fragile, system of compromise between diverse and disparate ambitions and ideologies represented by a variety of economic and political classes, though a classless society is enshrined in democratic myth. So long as no particular interest is powerful enough to fully and finally overwhelm its varied opponents, nor any alliance capable of singleness of purpose long enough to accomplish that end, a tacit respect for the laws and terms of constitutional democracy is maintained. At rare moments, an idea that might accidentally resemble social justice is sometimes enacted as law of the land, though opposing forces waste little time in their attempts to overturn whatever right might be to their disadvantage. Democracies are themselves compromises between dreamlike Edens of anarchy, socialist collectives of workers' paradises in which individual liberties are usually forfeit, as are most worldly possessions, including food and shoes, and aristocracies of one shape or another, which rule through tradition and privilege for the single purpose of their own comfort, which is historically at the expense of the great masses of impoverished citizens who are obliged to toil and obey. Democratic governments are most often inspired by rising classes of bourgeoisie, whose general outlook is liberal and progressive, yet seldom naive about the affairs of business and government. The political suffrage of the Democratic Republic is channeled by powerful political economic interests to stifle possibly contagious outbreaks of populism. Democracies face periodic crises when ideological concerns lose patience with legislative or judicial processes. Powerful, often retrogressive, and reactionary forces rise at times of rapid social transformation, which also generally include more than usual excesses of corruption, as well as strained economies. When ideologies rigidify into implacable positions that despise workable compromise, the likely result is civil violence, which might erupt on a skinhead scale, yet quickly escalate into savage extremes, such as an earlier American experience, 1861 to 1865. A distinction should be made between the violent reprisals of an uncompromising government and the uncompromising violence of a rapacious minority determined to undermine and overthrow the government. The current political climate in the United States is incendiary, which is reflected by condescending political parties that attempt to placate extreme right-wing ideologues who manipulate the democratic process to ultimately destroy it. One of the major parties in particular apes the reactionary agenda so far as to echo its clarion call for a religious war upon anyone or anything that is different or opposes a grim and vengeful vision of apocalyptic governance which excludes diversity, intelligence, and imagination, and which blames the nation's problems on such interesting and rather progressive citizens as feminists, gays, and lesbians, blacks, Hispanics, and recently arrived third world immigrants who hope for the future rather than cling to noxious images of the past. The proto-fascists who are determined to wrest power in the United States have tapped into the old leftist liberal populist tactics of grassroots organizing and ballot initiatives to promote laws that deny basic citizens' rights to anyone disagreeable or threatening to them. They intend that those who have never enjoyed the fruits of democracy, few and bitter as they are, shall never reach its tree. And though it might be argued that these reactionary and grossly unjust proposals are based on fear, the fear they inculcate should not be dismissed. And that was something I wrote. Keep your head. This is Michael McCusker. The engineer is Dylan Hauser-Schalk. Tomorrow is Mohandas Gandhi's 151st birthday. He was born October 2nd, 1869. As Donald Trump has told millions of lies, Mahatma Gandhi told as many and more millions of truths. Truth never damages a cause that is just, Gandhi said. Stay safe. Lock down and mask up. Read Gandhi. Protecting yourself protects everybody else. Gandhi might have said that, given present circumstances.